Welcome to the podcast with a cake.
With Christian Colley, James McLean, and Brian Terranova.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the podcast with a K. I'm Christian Colley, and he's James McLean.
Hello.
And we're here to talk Doctor Who related things, more or less. So there you go. And we're without Brian Turnover this week. The first thing we need to talk about in this week's podcast is the casting of a new male alien companion in Doctor Who.
Yes.
That didn't happen, did it?
No.
No. Instead, we have been blessed with Pearl Mackey, who was announced during halftime in the FA Cup semi-final match between Everton and Manchester United. What was that all about?
I don't know. It certainly caused a stir on social media.
Did it?
Well, yes. There's a great opposition people have between having to... There's just an opposition, isn't there, between sport and science fiction, which shocks people. You got the impression from some people that actually have to watch the entire match to actually, do you know what I mean? It wasn't, you could just sort of pop in and out. No, it was the fact it was within a sports match was just shocking. But yeah, so there we go.
Yeah, so Pearl Mackey, she graduated from the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School in 2010, played Anne-Marie Frazier in Doctors in 2014, so lots of TV work there, clearly. And is currently performing in the National Theatre's West End production of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night Time at the Gielgud, I believe. She obviously replaces Jenna Coleman, who's left in order to become Queen.
Yep.
In the 19th century. She says, Pearl Mackey, I'm incredibly excited to be joining the Doctor Who family. It's such an extraordinary British institution, I couldn't be prouder to call the TARDIS my home. Her press release writer added, Peter Capaldi is such a brilliant actor and his Doctor is such a wacky and wonderful character. I can't wait to see what adventures are in store for him. And perhaps this is where Estelle starts to become a little bit... this is probably what we're going to be talking about. I can't wait to see what adventures are in store for him and Bill throughout time and space. Mackie said her new character, Bill, was wicked, describing her as cool, strong, sharp, a little bit vulnerable, with a bit of geekiness thrown in. Sophie Aldred could not be drawn to comment.
Sounds rubbish, doesn't it? I hate sort of making comments like that before they've even really done a bit, but they did show his little clip. So I suppose in a sense we can sort of make a few little comments.
There is indeed a clip. If you haven't watched it yet, dear listener, go and knock yourself up a strong drink first and then click in the show notes.
Yeah. So that sort of gives you a peer, sort of feeling where you stand on it then.
Yeah. I mean, I like her and I like the interaction, but the dialogue is horrendous.
The dialogue was really bad. It felt sort of very sort of thing you'd imagine in a fan film. It was so sort of meta focused, so tension killing. And unfortunately, she was really, really, really irritating. I'm surprised they used that clip because it does not warm you to her at all.
I'm not surprised they used that. Lack of self-control in BBC Wales, I don't know. But yeah. Oh, hello, BBC Wales, by the way. We haven't said, hello there! Hello!
Yes. Someone must have thought it was a good clip, though. Someone must have thought.
I mean, it was it had nice elements to it. I mean, it was clearly just, single set with a few cuttings from inside the Dalek. I suspect it was, of the Dalek action shots.
Yeah, I don't know. I just... I echo the fact that I am bored of sort of the 20-something quirky, plucky female character from London, probably somewhere probably around the 21st century, and it's just dull.
Yeah. Do you think she's from London?
I'm guessing. I don't know. I mean, we don't know, but I mean, the bottom line is that for a show which is desperately trying to find stuff which feels new, this doesn't feel new.
No, no.
And I think it would be insulting to sort of say, well, because they've gone for a non-white companion, that's new. Well, it's been done. And if that was sort of the if that was their equivalency of doing something different, I think that's sort of vaguely an insult to race generally. That yeah. if that's if that's some sort of weird token value, I mean, I'm sure that just seems bad as well. I don't really believe that. I don't believe in the sort of the box ticking logic, you know, in the anti-PC brigade. I don't think that's really into it at all. I think she genuinely was probably the best actress that they for the role that they wanted to do. My issue is with the role, not the actress. I think that's the problem. And I've been quite glad, actually, to be honest, looking through things like the Guardian comments, which tend to be sort of fairly, well, they're always vitriolic, but, you know, people are very blunt about what they say because they always like to hang on to this sort of, well, I'm not going to be PC about this. So, but there hasn't been any sort of comments really on sort of the choice of you know, of it being not a white companion or being, you know, a non-white companion. There's been none of that, which is nice. Mm-hmm. It's nice that we seem to have got past that. The issue really is the writing, because she did her job fine. I mean, if she was there to fire off wacky, quirky lines, I didn't see any problem with what she was doing. It was just what she was being told to do.
Firing off wacky, quirky lines. Well.
Well, that's what it was. I mean,
if we're going to have a companion who bashes off wacky, quirky, or fires off wacky, quirky lines, then, you know, then she gains an added element of comparison with previous companions, doesn't she?
Well, this is it. I mean, you could probably take Jenna Coleman from Asylum of the Daleks and drop her in there and you wouldn't feel any difference. She could read that script and it would feel fine. It would feel normal. You could probably put Amy in there and do similar sort of things. And that is the problem.
Yeah.
Getting just a slightly different face to do it is not good for me. I just don't think that's right. I mean, as I say, I am glad that they are. There was this sort of thing that it was just going to be another, it's sort of inadvertently racist, it's going to be another white 20-something female. But I think people weren't really talking about the sort of the fact that she was white. They were talking more, about the fact that she represents the sort of 20-something youth. So it's not too much older than teens, they're out of the gap, and it's not too much older than 30, so they're out of the gap. So you've got this very safe female archetype who is, again, as we said, plucky, doesn't fear anything, so really adds nothing to the drama, is cocky, something that the Doctor has to sort of bounce off in a sort of predictable way. And that is what I think people are bored with.
Yeah.
And that's the real shame of it. And I kind of feel sorry for this girl, because she's obviously scored a good gig. I didn't see her in Doctors, I must admit, because I don't watch it. She's got a good gig.
You do surprise me.
And to be honest, I'm glad again that they're actually going for unknowns. I think that's good. You know, they're giving new people a chance to sort of show their face and get a footstool, a foot up in an industry which does love to sell stuff on names, on name capital. So I'm really glad they've gone that route. I like the way that they've gone for someone who is different, who has a different feel to her than the previous companion. So that's good as well. It's just what they give them is just so boring. That's it. I was just bored, and that's a real sad place to be.
Yeah.
You could just almost predict the lines, couldn't you? You could just tell what was coming, and you know, you're almost, you know, oh, and it just, I don't know. No. Yeah,
you're getting somewhere there, because, you know, Doctor Who, you know, there's this thing that, like, people go to rock concerts and they want to hear the same old songs all the time.
Yeah.
And people go to comedy gigs and they want to hear new jokes. And that's what we're getting here. We're getting the same stuff that we've had before. You know, when we were talking about what happened with Series 8?
Yeah.
And one of the things which we discussed briefly, was the at the beginning of the series, the promotion, just the Doctor and Clara in the TARDIS, same old, which doesn't really give it a particularly positive or enthusiastic ring to a new series of a show that's been going on for 10 years.
No.
And this is more of that, really, in many ways. You've got the Dalek, chasing, not doing anything particularly original, turn up late. Doctor having quote unquote witty banter with a companion, and yeah, more or less repeating what you've just said, I suppose. But there's nothing new about it.
No, that's it, and I think that really is a problem. It just feels. Well, we said this the other week, didn't we? That the problem is the show is getting on, and yet it doesn't feel half as diverse as the first 10 years of its original run.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
Yeah.
And this feels like no effort to change that. It feels as if it's sticking. Now, I've seen people say they've done the kiddie test and shown it to their 12-year-olds, and the 12-year-olds liked it.
Oh, good for them.
So, I mean, who knows? I mean, and again, to homogenize 12-year-olds into sort of one beast is a mistake in itself. But I think it's important to sort of say, well, how will this sit with younger audiences? And it might be different for them. But I tend to feel that a show like Doctor Who has always been about pushing boundaries. And when it hasn't, it's when it's sort of been... The press has often got quite critical with it when they feel that it is in, say, like in the 80s, where they felt it wasn't really pushing itself. Again, I'm not sure if that's totally fair. But right now, it really feels like it's crying for a new direction. I think what really irritated me about it was everyone knows the Daleks. Everyone knows what they are. This isn't 2005 where you have to justify the Daleks anymore. You don't have to justify the fact that they look a bit odd. That has gone. We did that in Dalek. Once you've done that, you shouldn't have to do it again, because otherwise you're starting to get to the point where you end up doing a Destiny of the Daleks, where you start to end up lampooning them to a point where they no longer have any strength. And so you have this really weird, stupid tension between the Doctor trying to reinforce the fact that they're dangerous and the companion unraveling it every moment, every second. And the last line where he sort of says, you know, you don't want them to get to killing you quicker. And she says, good point. It's too late. You've already unraveled all that. That they now seem ludicrous and a little absurd.
Yeah.
So that was really, for me, the real issue. So, yeah, I don't know. Anything else? I thought, you know, Capaldi was fine in it.
And oh, yeah.
So they seem to sort of have
his
a
comfort. His hair's looking good as well, I think.
I still don't like the old-fashioned look. I know a lot of people said they didn't like him trying to be younger, but I preferred him in the early last series, more relaxed look. I just don't like this John Pertwee velvet thing. It just looks a little odd on him.
Mm-hmm.
Makes him look a little too granddad, I guess. And I kind of like that sort of opposite to Smith, really, I guess, where Smith would wear older clothes than he actually is. I kind of like that with Capaldi. But...
More hoodies, then.
Yeah, I think so. What about you? I mean, did you prefer that? I know people sit on the fence on it. Well, they don't sit on the fence. One side or the other.
I probably am sitting on the fence because I don't mind either way, really. Mm. I think it's nice that he has the option to switch it around, and that it's not a 80s style uniform plastered in question marks. But I really don't mind either way what he wears. I think he looks cool in whatever, really.
I mean, I think. Again, one of the other issues with this is that you could argue, well, that they could be setting this scene up so later on she sees how truly terrible the Daleks are. And from laughing at them, she will be sort of stunned at their sheer malevolence or how many people they kill. But ultimately, I don't believe in that situation, even some crazy zany girl of Doctor Who type would be laughing at something which is shooting at them. Or seemed to be anyway in that clip.
Did you get the feeling that that was a clip from a story or something that was specially written?
Well, they seemed to suggest it was a clip from a story, but if it was, I would obviously think it would have to be the Christmas one. But I don't know. So, I mean, if it doesn't exist with any further data, without any further connections, then it's a poor clip, because, as I say, I think it just demolishes the Daleks, which is something you don't really want to do after 10 years of exposure to a new audience. You don't want to start picking on their silliness.
No.
And equally, it doesn't help her. And again, if it's part of a larger story, I still think it's unrealistic. She just comes across as unrealistic. I don't think anyone would be like that in that situation, no matter what they look like. And to be honest, the Daleks these days don't look that stupid. I don't think you'd be... You know, unless you had a good time to study them, you would really notice the sucker thing. That's just something that, you know, the audience are aware of. It's too meta-relevant. It's too aware of its audience to feel confident with itself. Dear me, I'm really slacking it off, which is such a shame. As I say, it's nice to see, you know, a fresh, different face. And I saw one girl in comments saying that they liked with Jenna Coleman that she was, you know, an unknown, which I think, and the guy got slammed for it. And I can understand why, because, yes, yeah, she wasn't an unknown. I mean, she was certainly, you know, Emma Dale. She was a face in that. And then what's the high school one that she was in?
Thingy Road, the one moved to Scotland. Waterloo Road.
Waterloo Road. Yeah. So, you know, she was known to two different sort of catchment groups as well. Yeah. But in fairness, she wasn't a big, big name. So, again, yeah, I'm trying to find things to commend them with. I think, yes, I think it was an interesting choice because she's got a unique flair about her and she seemed to be a good actress. I just feel that they're just going to do the same things with her as they've done before. And yeah. She's going to have a lot of stuff. I kind of feel sorry for her in that press release from the PR, you know, this whole thing about she's excited to be on board. Because I'm thinking probably after she's read some of the comments tonight, she might be thinking, oh, God. You know, well,
yeah, I noticed she's on Twitter as well. I can't see that lasting.
No, regardless of whether you're good or not on Twitter,
get off it, definitely.
Yeah.
For your own sanity, yeah. As you did.
Yeah, absolutely. I came off it for the same reason. I just felt, you know, it was too invasive. It was too negative, and yeah, it was just bloated. Mm. So I mean, I certainly, if I was in her position, I would have no social media presence at all. I might have a Facebook group for my, you know, friends that no one else could get into, and I'd let an agent or whatever do anything else. So yeah, no, yeah, definitely don't get involved.
What do you think of the name?
Oh, Bill.
Yeah. So the first thing that came to mind was Dulce and the Bannermen with Ray. Yeah, so she's called Bill, which is, I don't know, maybe her surname's Piper. I don't know.
I thought Ace was the thing that came to my mind with the description mentioned.
Well, I mentioned that at the top, yeah. Does that feel dated to you, or is this something that's happening now again? People are dressing like Sophie Aldridge.
I mean, a lot of people have sort of been debating the sort of, and obviously it's not, but they've been debating the transsexual sort of thing, you know, it's especially, I suppose, because it's a lot in the news with America and political issues around things around there with states and toilets and all this, restrooms. But I personally just think it's meant to sound quirky and humorous. And
that's what I thought as well. Presumably she's called Belinda Raw.
That's
it. As the great Clayton Hickman, or was it either Hickman or Gareth Roberts observed on Twitter, perhaps her name is Wilhelmina Hartnell.
Well, yeah, it's just a. Unless it's Ray's boyfriend, Billy.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. Again, I think it makes too much of a statement for me. It's as if. I suppose names have to, or maybe they're trying to sort of. But the way they sort of put it out there.
That's a, I mean, you can use names as shorthand, can't you? But this is kind of a very dated method of doing that shorthand, isn't it? This isn't like that's not something you expect from a programme in the 21st century that's, you know, primetime Saturday evening to call its quirky new female character Bill.
It felt a bit hard on, and the way they sort of used it within the actual promotion, clearly they were looking to make a stir.
Yeah, do you know? Actually, I'm gonna make this comparison, and then we'll move on. This whole reveal is, and maybe I'm channeling Brian with this. Brian, who's too busy to join us because he's sunning himself in Florida. This all feels like Class all over again.
How so?
In terms of, I'm feeling very meh about it all. I'm thinking that there's good intentions in this, but really, are they needed? Are they the right intentions? Are they presented in the right way? Has the right level of thought been given to this and how it will be received?
I don't feel there's been much thinking out of the box. It just feels. I don't know.
Numbers?
Yeah, it just feels by numbers. The other person I was speaking to tonight about it, and he was just like, I'm just not interested. He says, this show has been dead to me for 3 years. And I know that's a sort of very typical sort of fan comment, but he's not actually a fan. He's not a Doctor Who fan. But It is. People would say it's an overreaction for a TV series, but I think there is for me an absolute feeling of apathy. I mean, I've got things I'm watching at the moment which excite me, and I watch that, and I'm not.
Yeah, yeah. And Game of Thrones is on in 2 days' time, so.
I think that's the problem. I think there's a lot of stuff that's coming out now, which I think with things like Netflix, there's a lot of stuff coming out which is in the same sort of sphere, which will pull people away from Doctor Who to some degree. There's a lot of competing interests, and a lot of these competing interests, you know, are taking risks or doing something different. And I think it. I mean, obviously, we've got Chris Chibnall within, you know, just over a year or so, well, a little more than that. So we have got something new on the horizon in theory. But I think we did hope that with the issues of last series and with the pressures to do something different to prepare for a handover, that this would feel. Well, we feel this every year, don't we? We kind of sort of expect something new, and it never happens. You know, we sort of thought with Danny Pink that would be something a little more integrated and different.
It was different, but it just didn't really work, did it?
No. No, I mean, he was okay enough, but the way they used him was in the wrong way. He didn't invigorate the TARDIS crew, and they need things to invigorate it. They need things to make it feel different, and they just don't seem to be able to do it. They seem to be too scared about breaking format. That seems to be the issue. It feels like the show is locked in this fear of breaking format.
The show, with its amazing format where it can do anything, is not doing that.
It's just locked down, and it's been locked down now for 10 years, and the format just doesn't change. Yeah, you get a different flavour and different, you know, qualitative responses to each series. Some people love these new ones, some people don't, but the actual format just is the same. It's the same sort of characters, same sort of story arcs, same sort of quality, same sort of... It just doesn't feel like it's able to... I think they try... I think that's the sad thing. You can feel they're trying occasionally, but you feel they don't dare to really try. So you get these sort of very slight efforts to make something different. But ultimately, they just don't seem to... And the thing is, we've said on this podcast, and I'm sure 1,000 other podcasts, and I'm sure all the people listening to this in their home have ideas of how they could break format. And there are loads of them. And the most obvious one is to make a big change to the companion. But they just don't seem to want to do it. I don't even think changing the Doctor to a female is a breaking format thing, because in theory that should still be the same character. Again, it comes back down to, you know, differences between gender or race shouldn't be that different. So a female Doctor should still be the Doctor. So while that would be different, it wouldn't break format, if that makes sense. So I think, you know, to break format, you've got to really change things. You know, change the numbers in the TARDIS, maybe. Break, yeah, there's just loads of ways. Put him on Earth for a bit, or put him on a different planet for a little bit. You know, it doesn't have to be Earth. You know, get him to connect with people. Make some darker endings. Put them in historicals. There's loads of ways to just sort of shift things about a bit. And where are they? Where are they?
Oh. Okay, so all the best to Pearl Mackey. We hope you can have a great time with Doctor Who, and that the writing tightens itself up and does you the service that your talent obviously deserves.
Yeah,
and we will see how it goes with the Christmas episode, presumably, or beyond, perhaps. Okay, let's move on. You know, there's something that I'm intrigued about. And that is this new Torchwood revival that seems to be happening almost on its own. And not only have we got a big Finnish series, we've also got a comic strip. Have you seen that? There's a new Torchwood magazine.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Written by one John Barrowman.
Oh, John.
Let me just bring this one up for you. I'll say that in the nicest possible way. John Barrowman to write Torchwood comic series. This is in collaboration again with his sister Carol E. Barrowman. I think they wrote a book or a previous or an audio play in the past, or maybe more than one. And it's from Titan. So it's basically Titan doing with Torchwood what they're done with Doctor Who, which gives a bit of surprise. I mean, it's like is there a huge groundswell? And I don't want to be disparaging to Torchwood, because it had its good points, and, you know, Series 3, Children of Earth was fantastic. Best thing BBC had done for a long time in the science fiction stakes. But is there really a huge groundswell of opinion saying bring Torchwood back? It feels to me to be a bit manufactured. How do you feel? What do you think?
I'm surprised, being that I can't imagine there's that much demand, but maybe, I don't know. But I still kind of like it when people who are involved in the show so much interest in it. And I do really feel with him that he is genuine interest in it. It's not like someone capitalizing on...
Yeah, it's like Paul Darrow we were talking about last time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's someone who does have an interest in a character they've played. And I think... I mean, I remember Barrowman was always thrilled over his action figure, wasn't he? He was that sort of... he has that sort of love. And I suppose it is a pretty exciting action role to play, isn't it? It must be one of the most unusual roles.
Yeah, I mean, he's never going to get a role more sort of multifaceted than Captain Jack, is he?
No, well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean, he is a comic strip character in a lot of ways, but doesn't mean he's any less fun or interesting, and he just seems to enjoy playing him. I think it's a shame that the Torchwood universe just never really found its... I mean, apparently these Big Finish things are very good. I've not heard any of them, of the Torchwood, but I still find the problem with Torchwood is, especially with its legacy, I couldn't tell you what its voice is. You know, I'd say a Doctor Who is about, you know, you could just use the madman in a box, couldn't you, whatever. But with Torchwood, it's not really about the institution, is it? It's not really about Captain Jack.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it's about Gwen, couldn't you?
Well, yeah, maybe you could. Maybe you could say it's the story of Gwen Cooper. I don't know. It is just a bit of a... sort of lacks structure to me. It lacks a spine, and I don't mean that in a rude way, but well, some of it was bad for me personally, but it just didn't seem to know what direction it was going in.
You know, there's this theory about Harry Potter being that everything's in his head.
I'd not heard that, yeah, probably because I didn't care. But
well, okay. Yeah, so the idea is everything's in Harry Potter's head. He's a child with mental problems who's in care, and everything that we see in the films is all just stuff that's, it's all fantasy. You could possibly apply that same idea to Gwen Cooper, and that everything that's happening in Torchwood is all in her head, because she is the focus of pretty much every episode, with only one or possibly two exceptions.
Well, you could sort of say in that first episode, there's a period where, I can't remember it well, she blacks out, isn't there? Isn't there a period where she wakes up somewhere, or no?
Yeah, well, she gets retconned by Jack, doesn't she?
I just wondered whether there was an incident. I'd have to rewatch the first episode, which could sort of, like Life on Mars, have a moment where the universe does become about her, because it's not our universe anymore, as you say, whether it's in her head or... And, you know, is there a moment in there where she could have been shot or attacked before Captain Jack appears? And of course, that would mean the whole Doctor Who's in her head.
Well, not all of it.
Well, new series, maybe. Classic series is safe.
So, so it's happening. So we've got that in print, and then we've got Torchwood Series 2. We're up to Series 2 already on Big Finish.
Yeah.
With the return of a man called Ianto Jones. Gareth David Lloyd returning, reprising his Torchwood role with John Barrowman in a story that apparently takes place in a pub, or starts in a pub, anyway. So, yeah, so that's that. So, hello, Torchwood. Interesting to see you back in such a way. Are you listening to Big Finish at the... Big Finish at the moment, James McLean? Not right now. No. I know, not right now. You're talking to me. But, I mean, have you listened to any recently?
No.
Okay. So you've not... I mean, do you have any interest in the 10th Doctor and Donna audios?
I listened to the... I listened to the previews, when the previews came out a few months ago, and right. I thought they sounded very spot on.
Right.
not just them, but the sort of dialogue and the whole feel felt like the new series. So I imagine if that's what you're after, they'd be pretty good. I must admit, I have no real motivation to actually hear them. I mean, I don't know whether if that's a bit of what I think Brian would probably call sort of like new series fatigue.
I think you probably would. I think at the moment I'm kind of more interested in non-.2.2 things.
Yeah.
I like the Jagon Lightfoot stuff. I haven't listened to a lot of it. I listened to the first two series. I want to listen to, for instance, the countermeasures stuff. I want to have a sample of countermeasures when I get the opportunity. But I'm not. I don't seem to be a lot of Who. A lot of Dot Who, I should say. There isn't a lot of the Who because there's only half of them left. But you know, there is a lot of Doctor Who.
I still think a lot of this, and I think we said this the other week, that we've had, like, the 10th, 12th year, isn't it? It's 11th year of Doctor Who, since it came back. And in that original classic era, within 11 years, so 63 to 74, there seemed to be a lot more variety of tone and style, which is part of the era. So I'm not sort of having a go at the new series per se, but I think I think the suggestion is that within that short period of time, there is a lot of different styles there to enjoy. So if your mood is in a certain, for historicals, you've got John Pertwee, or you've got the Avengers type, sorry, William Hartnell, Avengers type for John Pertwee. And you've even got a bit of Tom Baker there, maybe. But with the new Who, it is very much all very similar stuff, which is never bad. It's not saying it's bad, but you don't have that sort of difference in style. It's all structured very similar. So maybe that's why there's a bit of fatigue. There's no real sense of that much difference between the eras. I still don't think there is, not massively. There is, but...
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it's more stylistic than...
I mean, even down to the, sort of the aesthetics, isn't it? The aesthetics all sort of... You could interchange the eras and they wouldn't look particularly out of place. You could put in how the designs are and everything else. It all feels very much the same, which is in some ways some people would argue is good. I don't know. I kind of feel it feels a little, it ends up feeling a bit samey. But so maybe that's it. But I think it's great. I think it's great they're doing them. I think it's great for people like Tennant and Tate, who clearly enjoy working together and have a good rapport. They can enjoy the characters without having to be contracted to
run up and down,
you know, for several months of their lives. So for vast amounts of money. No, but yeah, I think it's good. I think I like it. I like that for that reason. I like the fact that, you know, that these people who are interested in these characters can go out and try them again, sort of without too much disruption to their careers. I like that. It's cool.
Okay, speaking of people within characters, or specifically characters, and also continuing on from David Tennant, he and Matt Smith appeared together at the Wizard World Convention in New York City.
Yeah, I saw some pictures
and
of that.
And he discovered that Matt and Karen Gillan first met not on Doctor Who, but when they auditioned for Merlin. Matt auditioned for Merlin himself and Karen Gillan for Guinevere.
Merlin? Guinevere, right.
For Arthur. No, for Guinevere. So that's interesting. Interesting how these casting things turn out, isn't it? Because you often, you know, I mean, it's happened in Doctor Who, where people have been cast in one role and then they've been moved into other roles, or they've gone in to see... we've got Colin Baker, who was in Doctor Who twice within the space of about a year, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree. I think what was interesting in that convention as well, one of the biggest story that I saw reported wasn't that, was that some fan had given David Tennant a Capaldi-like jacket and sunglasses to wear in their shoot, and that just rocketed around the internet as being like him in cosplay. Yeah, look, Tennant doing Capaldi, and Twitter crying over this sort of wonderful moment, which seemed a little little melodramatic to
Twitter,
me. But...
Melodramatic? Surely not.
No, I know. But no, people got a lot out of that, and I think it's kind of fun. I like people to have happy days, and if that's what makes you happy. I must admit, it would be very interesting to see those two. I kind of like seeing the photos of seeing Smith and Tennant on the stage together, because they just both look so very comfortable with themselves. and yet very different in their body language. And yet at the same time, in the fiction, you're looking at them and thinking, yeah, they're the same person in a weird way. And yet they're not, because they're actors. And I, yeah, so.
Yeah, I know where you are with that. I know what you're saying. Listen, do you own any vinyl?
Not anymore. I used to when I was young and vinyl was in.
But no longer.
But then CDs came along, and despite the huff, puff, and blow your house down of vinyl enthusiasts that it's the better medium, I tend to find that CDs are easier, and I still think a lot of people wouldn't be able to notice the difference.
I appreciate what you're saying there, and I think I'm more of a tactile sort of a person when it comes to things like this, so I appreciate both formats because you can pick stuff up and look at it and like read through it, and you know.
Well, it's big, isn't it? I mean, there is that argument. I mean, you don't have posters on your wall. Well, of course, at our age, you don't have posters on your wall. But you don't get tiny ones the size of a jeans pocket. You get something a little bigger. And, you know, obviously with an LP.
Ah, but with an MP3, you don't get anything, do you? You can look at something on your computer screen. Maybe.
Oh, I see. So you're going one step ahead of me because I was still thinking of CDs.
Yeah, I would go with vinyls and CDs. I'm very happy with that, but I'm very loath to pay for MP3s. What I probably mostly do is if they're for charity or if they're like there was a video game soundtrack released from Turrican, which was an 8-bit and 16-bit video game from the 80s and 90s. I bought the soundtrack for that because I didn't think I was going to be able to get a physical copy of it.
I don't know. I do actually buy MP3s now. I think because I've got so sick of moving to different place and having to lug everything around that my CDs are now getting to be quite old. You know, it's kind of scary. I look at, you know, I've got a Lalo Schifrin Mission Impossible CD of all his sort of Latin jazz from it. And I got that in like 1993. You know, it's like, oh my God, how old is that CD now? It's over 20 years old. That to me seems like a total confusion.
I've got a 3-inch micro disc.
Really?
All right. A 3-inch CD from the late 80s of Van Halen. Oh, my wife was amused by that as well. She didn't even hear what he said.
Did you get the? I remember in the 80s when Oink was a magazine and they had their square pink record.
Right. No. I haven't seen that. Was it a flexi disc?
Yes, it was a
flexi disc. I've got Monty Python's Tiny Black Round Thing from the New Musical Express in 1973 or 74. Apparently they did two discs, the Pythons, with NME. They did that one, and then they did one where they had... it was half the length of a normal disc because they had two grooves cut in it. One of them... Oh, was it... One of them was silent, or they had two different sketches on the same side. One of the two. So you'd play it, and it'd give you, you know, a sketch or a series of sketches. Then you'd put it on again, and it'd play a completely different selection because you've got two concurrent spirals of groove going. That's so clever. The reason I mentioned vinyl is because we've had Record Store Day over the weekend, and there have been, would you believe, some Doctor Who releases for Record Store Day. Some remastered LPs of the 1960s soundtrack soundtracks to the 1960s movies Starring Peter Cushing, Doctor Who and the Daleks, and Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Okay, there's some nice music on those.
They've been quite well received, it would seem. The Vinyl Factory picked it as one of the best LPs of Record Store Day 2016, saying they might not be as instantly appealing as the Radiophonic Workshop's finest output, but with the suite of sounds from Gerry Anderson collaborator Barry Gray, they're not to be sniffed at. I don't know why I did that like I'm voicing a newsreel. But
I think they were. I think, to be fair, they were more listenable than a lot of Doctor Who music was. I mean, there's occasional pockets of Doctor Who music, which was fun, but they were proper soundtracks.
Really, the movies, weren't they? There was also a release of Genesis of the Daleks.
Oh, yeah.
The Tom Baker linked narration squeezed down into...
Well, you say squeeze, but I think it's actually a better length.
Yeah. Could well be. I never had the vinyl, I had the cassette.
Yeah, I had the cassette as well, the dual one with slipback. Did you not have the dual one with slipback?
I may have got it second hand.
Ah, well, mine was the radio, BBC Radio Collection. It was slipback and Genesis of the Daleks. Two utterly disconnected productions which have no relationships at all. Yeah, but
I'm glad you came in there, because actually what I thought you were going to say was Genesis of the Daleks 2, and I was thinking, have I missed one?
Oh, no, that would be... no, we haven't had really another Genesis. I suppose you could say that first episode of the last series was a Genesis of the Daleks 2, if you wanted one.
Well, yeah. No, you have, of course it was.
The Sorceress Magician's Apprentice, whatever it was called. I can't remember, but yeah, it's that one.
We were talking, Brian and Genesis... I, last week about Michelle Gomez getting a BAFTA nomination for Missy. What do you think of that?
I think it's a difficult one, isn't it? I think it's good in the sense that you don't really get many female roles where you're allowed to be as over the top as that. And so I kind of like it in the sense there's a certain acknowledgement of some decent material for one gender, which doesn't tend to get many exciting, you know, characters like that. So as I say, these over the top roles. So that's kind of good. But at the same time, I sometimes kind of feel that, you know, these over the top characters are a lot easier to play than perhaps some of the subtle characters, which probably should get the BAFTAs. When you've got very little to work with and you can make that work, that to me seems like a far better success than when you're given, you know, virtually a panto character. But yeah, good on her. I mean, she seemed to enjoy herself, and certainly she gave it life.
Undoubtedly so.
What
do you think of, you know, you're talking about OTT characters. What do you think of the idea that...
Brian Blessed.
No, you're kind of in the right ball area, I suppose. What do you think of the idea that it kind of can overshadow, or ruin's not the right word, but sort of like leave a lasting taste in the career of an actor? I'm thinking specifically on this occasion of Richard E. Grant with Withnell and I.
You know, I always find this sort of debate a little retrospective, because you can never tell how their career would have gone without Withnell and I. And I think there's a certain, I'm not talking about Richard E. Grant, but I think there can be an arrogance, and I think we've said this before, that when people feel they've been typecast for roles which are highly noticeable, that if they didn't have that role, their career would have skyrocketed. And I don't know. I mean, Richard E. Grant's a good actor, and he's got great, great eyes. He's got good versatility, but he's not got that sort of generic attractiveness that so many shows want. He's an oddball look, which is what sells him. But then that's also what got gets him those oddball roles, because he's got that sort of unique style. And as soon as you do something unique, by definition, you're not going to be looking at doing things that are the same. So you are going to hem down what you're going to be sort of, you're going to get. You're not going to get certain types of roles. So he's a tough one. Without it, maybe he'd have gone nowhere. Maybe Withnell and I gave him a better career or more visible career than if he hadn't done it. Or maybe he was always born to sort of play characters which were a little more English over the top than others. Maybe that was just what he excels at. He's got to deal with that. I mean, I think I love the fact that Brian Blessed seems to sort of be very happy with his career. And I mean, to be fair to him, I mean, while he's done a lot of shouty roles, he's had a lot of versatility as well. He's done serious roles. He has done a lot of comedy, straight comedy. He's done the stuff which mixes the two, and he's done stuff which is very vibrant. So it's not like he's been constantly stuck. I mean, what he was doing in Zed Cars is very different to Flash Gordon, you know. Even Blake 7 to the Sweeney is ones that are just springing off the top of my head.
I like him as the sort of non-shouty, threatening bad guy.
Yes, I was thinking the Sweeney when I was thinking that, when he played in, the one he played in the Sweeney was very much that. And maybe a little, well, no, he did shout a lot of Blake
7. Yes, he did.
Yes, he did. Yeah, that was a bad choice, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah. But I think you need those characters. I mean, they may not sort of allow them the versatility. I think very few are lucky enough to play that and get versatility. But they do add colour to the history of film and television. I mean, Blackadder, I think of that original series of Blackadder. All I can think of him shouting for Chiswick to get the fresh horses, or, you know, getting Edmund's name wrong. And that. Yes, exactly. Those sort of things, you know, Flash Gordon's legacy is pretty much built on his sound bites. And so I think, in a sense, maybe that's a sacrifice they have to pay, is that while they may sort of not shine so brightly in as many different roles, they colour the history with memorable moments. So yeah, I think, and of course, when they don't do that, then they get shunned, don't they? If they get that, I think that is the problem they have, isn't it? As soon as they play something which is over the top, when they don't, there's disappointment. So I suppose that is probably the argument they would have, is that it limits their roles because people don't feel as energized when they see them in more subdued roles, and that can therefore affect people's appreciation of a production.
He's written a book, published his diaries recently, going, I think it's called With Nails. I read it a few years ago. He was cast in Robin Hood Prince of Thieves as the Sheriff of Nottingham, but was unable to fulfil that due to the overrunning of Hudson Hawk. Now, in both films, he's playing a kind of what you've just basically described, an over-the-top English oddball with added villainy. Then, have you seen Hudson Hawk?
I have, yes. I don't remember it very well, apart from an excellent opening scene where there's the adulterer in the cupboard, right, in the closet. I remember, yeah, that's the only bit I remember of it.
A difficult watch, I seem to recall.
It has a reputation.
Yeah. And of course, with Prince of Thieves, they cast Alan Rickman instead, who was fresh off Die Hard.
Yes, that's unfortunate. Well, not unfortunate, he was good, but I mean unfortunate for Richard.
So it's especially. So Alan Rickman never had anything to do with Doctor Who.
No, surprising that. Again, another one you'd have thought. I mean, I suppose he was connected a couple of times. I'm sure there's been tons of people who suggested him.
And I'm pretty sure he was mentioned in the press back in the day, back in 2004.
Yeah, exactly.
2004.
Yeah, Hudson Hawk, Die Hard. Yeah, there was one was a good choice. Yeah. The other was Hudson Hawk.
So have you been watching anything on TV recently?
I have been watching of late the Clone Wars.
Oh, the cartoon series. Should we watch that or not?
I finished Rebels, which has been the continuation, which is set a few years before New Hope, and that's a fantastic series. That really, as I've said that before, it's well worth watching. It's got everything that Star Wars is meant to be about. But what I like about the Clone Wars is it doesn't have that same sort of friendliness that's within the Rebels series. But when people have always complained about Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, and I always have, the Clone Wars is just a beautiful bit of television which does what television just so rarely is able to do, and that's to bridge two fairly bad things and make something good. And you get this wonderful, because Anakin Skywalker, the problem with him is that you're meant to really like the character in the same way that you like Luke Skywalker. That's the whole point, is that he's a rogue. And Luke goes one way and Anakin goes the other. But unfortunately, Hayden and the script just never managed to pull that off. So you have this like six series, Clone Wars saga, which allows you to actually see what Anakin would be like as a hero. And for every success that they get, you've always got this feeling, this guy is going to ruin everything. There's a great, you feel the tragedy to it all. And you see all these setups, and they play on things that they know, things which people are wary about, like Ben Kenobi, or sorry, Obi-Wan Kenobi has a real disinterest in droids, which sort of plays off a little off, New Hope, where he's like, I've never owned a droid before. He's practically a racist in the Clone Wars, Droids can be destroyed for all he cares. They're just tools, which I know doesn't sound very racist. But then when you think of them in New Hope, where there is that racist,
cantina.
Yeah, there's very much the whole sort of color trope, isn't it? That sort of reflection on apartheid and like that. It does make you feel, oh my god, he's a bit of a racist, really, isn't he? And it's just interesting. Droidist. And I just think it's droidist. Yeah, absolutely, definitely droidist. And I think that's a really, it just makes it a really interesting run, and they're beautifully done. They're done in a 40s style where you have, they open up with this really loud, boisterous narrator, Obi-Wan Kenobi has been captured by the devious General Grievous. Meanwhile, Anakin Skywalker rushes to Coruscant, and it's all this sort of very much 40s film serial approach, which is obviously what Star Wars was based on. So it sits beautifully within that Star Wars canon too, unlike The Force Awakens, which feels like it's only referencing Star Wars. It doesn't seem to understand that Star Wars is a pastiche of all these old action-adventure shows. So it's beautiful. It really is worth watching. I know I've gone on about it a lot, but I think, you know, George Lucas, especially when he was running Star Wars before Disney took over, used to get such stick for everything. And that is one part of his legacy, which I think is overlooked and should be reassessed.
Is this the one that has David Tennant in for a short time?
I think it might be, although some Star Wars fan out there is going, "No, you ignoramus."
Well, they've only done two series, haven't they? And if it's not the prequel series.
Yeah, Clone Wars. And,
so it must be Clone
Rebels,
Wars.
Yes.
It must be Clone Wars. I'm pretty sure it's
yeah.
Clone Wars.
As I say, I literally didn't pay much attention. Literally didn't pay much attention to this great English. I didn't pay any attention, really, to Clone Wars. Figuratively. Well, not figuratively, because I didn't pay attention. I just didn't pay attention to Star Wars, Clone Wars, when it came out. So I only really got interested in it when I started watching Rebels. And I'd seen a couple of episodes on its run, Clone Wars, but. And I'd worked on a Clone Wars game, I suppose. So I had some vague interest. That was kind of interesting, watching these early episodes and actually seeing the scenes which I had pulled out of Lucas's vault to manipulate for the video game, and going, "Oh, I recognise that shot. I spent a lot of time using that shot to make an intro scene." So there was, yeah, it was kind of weird like that. But no, yeah, so I don't know much about it at all.
What about Rebels, then?
Rebels is really good. Rebels is exactly what you'd think if you were going to try and make a Star Wars show. In the same way people think of a Star Wars video game, you think, well, if you're going to do a spin-off of Star Wars, you'd probably set it on a Millennium Falcon, wouldn't you? And then you'd put all those tropes and archetypes, which are really popular. You'd have a smuggler, you'd probably have a Jedi, you'd have a weird, wacky alien, you'd have a good female character.
Now, this is why the Knights of the Old Republic game was so popular.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It follows that logic. Totally right. Yeah, absolutely. Knights of the Old Republic did it first, and they did it brilliantly. And it took that for television and film to suddenly realise, actually, that's a good idea. That's everything. It's like taking the bit when the Millennium Falcon leaves Mos Eisley and before it gets to the Death Star and doing a series on it. And that segment is gold for television, for serial. So, yes, it plots the story of this very small group of rebels at the beginning of Rebels, and how that slowly blossoms out into the rebellion, essentially. And it's the very early steps, and it's serial, and it changes. So there is a continuity to it, and the characters change as well. And it can be fun, it can be light, but it can occasionally be quite dark. People do die. It doesn't always pull its punches. The end of season two is got an Empire Strikes Back feel to it. So it really is a really good series. But I think if you have the time, if you can actually see some of Clone Wars first, I think you'll get more out of it, because there's a lot of references to Clone Wars in it. There's a lot of characters reappear, older, more jaded, that were in the Clone Wars, which, again, when you see them in Rebels, will carry far much more. They'll carry far more interest, won't they? When you can think of those 6 years of seeing them fighting the... Because you don't get that in television, do you? That's what's so cool about, I suppose, Star Wars, is you've got so many eras which you get to used to that, you know, when you have a character on television, it goes back when I was a lad and I was in the war. It's like a war story, but you actually get to see the war stories and also see them talk about it. And that's weird.
It's certainly unusual.
So, yeah, it's very exciting. I suppose Doctor Who has a bit of that to it as well. I suppose it's not quite the same, but... There is that continuity is interesting like that, when you can experience it in different eras and see how it reflects on each other.
Yeah, but, I see that. Well, I might check those out. Listen, something else I've checked out recently, well, I wasn't really checking out because I'd already seen it. I watched it again, The Force Awakens.
I know a lot of
people sort of like went to the pictures, saw it, and then went back the day after, and then the day after, and then the day after, and then the day after, then got a matinee and went in the same evening. I didn't do that. I only watched it once, and then I rewatched it a couple of weeks ago. With my little boy, and he enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
Right.
He was a bit baffled about Han Solo.
Now, had he seen the
originals?
Yes,
he has. He's seen the proper originals.
Right, so he's seen the proper originals, so he could relate this was Han Solo from those stories.
And he's absolutely obsessed by Chewbacca.
So did he enjoy the originals?
Yeah, he loves the originals. He particularly enjoys the first two.
He likes the first and doesn't like the third one. That's interesting. Given the third one was more heavily focused on the kid market, wasn't it? You'd think that's interesting. So that fails to kids, where Star Trek and Empire doesn't. So how does he compare it to Force Awakens?
I know he enjoys it and he wants to watch it again. So
wake him up. No.
Not tonight. No way. But yeah, I mean, I know he wants to watch it again. So, and he, as I say, he absolutely loves Chewbacca. So he even does a sort of a. I mean, I've done it on the podcast before. I'll do it now. He does that when he can as well. So
he's an odd lad, Chewbacca. I can't imagine many people going for Chewbacca. So, what's about you? How did you feel? Because you obviously are.
I enjoyed
no offense
watching
to
it
him,
again.
But you're more intelligible.
I enjoyed watching it again. I can see the criticisms. But I think there's something else going on in there which is possibly overlooked because of the criticisms of similarity with the original movie. And, you know, it's got a lot to do for a first movie in a new series. And I would say trilogy, but really it's the first movie in a new series, isn't there? Because we've got the spin-off movies, the standalones.
It's never going to end.
Well, that's pretty much it, isn't it? And I think it manages to do exactly what it needs to do. So that's pretty much my opinion on it.
Okay. Do you think it should have been better, or do you think it could have been better, or do you think what you got was better than what could have happened?
It could have been better if the Kylo Ren actor was less like Hayden Christensen. But that's pretty much my only criticism, really. I do think he's too close to Hayden Christensen. In it's just mannerism and delivery, and age as well is a key factor there as well.
I think my concern, one of the concerns I have with it is and this seems to be prevalent now in industry reactions, is that if something doesn't manage to give you all the right information, then you say, you'll say, okay, it doesn't give you all the right information, it doesn't explain itself. They'll say, well, it's because it's going to do it in the next episode. And I still kind of feel that becomes a bit of a cop-out. It didn't feel to me as if it was posing questions, let alone really expecting for you to expect answers. What someone I was talking to the other day was saying, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, J.J. Abrams likes to talk about the magic box principle, that, you know, you put your magic box into your story, and then people are so spellbound by this magic box they're desperate to follow you until you can explore, you know, open it and show everyone the excitement inside, and like Empire Strikes Back. But as this was actually mentioned on Cracked, you know, Empire Strikes Back was not a magic box scenario. No one was thinking whether Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's father, so you didn't have that was like as my colleague said, was like a twist. And I kind of feel that was the problem here, is it sort of doesn't really have a magic box on who Rey's parents are. Neither does it really try and pose it or particularly try and answer it. And so it just sort of meanders a bit. But my biggest issue with it, as I've said before, I think, in this podcast, is that it just doesn't feel like it's confident in what it's doing. And I heard that, you know, I think someone was saying the other day that around about in post, J.J. Abrams started to get nervous. You know, before that he was very confident, but when it came to the point where he was starting to see all the PR stuff starting to accumulate, ready to promote, that's when he started to get a bit worried. And you kind of feel that. And I still, you know, things like Luke not speaking at the end, I feel that that's always said to be a late addition. And to me, that feels like a bit of a, that shouldn't have happened. People have gone there to see that Luke and that Han. You know, there's certain expectations. I don't think leaving him to the end really worked. Certainly not when you took the whole thing off the search for Skywalker and went to go and find a Death Star to fight. You know, there's too many similarities to Star Wars that didn't need to be there, and they didn't fit with the story they were playing. So, yeah, there's loads of issues there, but good new cast.
Yeah, definitely. I particularly like the cast.
And it's interesting that, as you say, your son liked it. I think that's interesting because they're the sort of people who will stick with. So if they're enjoying it, I think that's good. I just don't think it's quite as structured as Empire or Star Wars.
What about the other movie trailer? Oh, the other movie, or the trailer for the other movie, Rogue One?
It looks good. Aesthetically, it looks, the tone of it looks good.
It looks very different to anything that Star Wars has done before. In cinema,
I think the whole fan thing about, you know, this the media promoting this fan reaction of it being a woman and being sort of these misogynistic or disparaging remarks.
It's funny because I'm pretty certain there's a Princess Leia, and I think there's a girl called Rey in the latest film.
Yeah, well, let's be fair, though. They are pretty much the only women in Star Wars. I mean, apart from a couple of other people who sort of shake a hand at the camera and then pushed off stage right. There isn't a massive female... although, yes, I would agree, things like Mon Mothma, even Aunt Beru, you know, they're not bad women archetypes. They're, you know, quite strong in their own ways. But my issue was less to do with it being a woman. In fact, it wasn't about it being a woman at all. I just kind of felt that what she was saying was that standard archetype, the rebel, you know, with the standard one-liners, you know, sort of basically the... It was just a callback to the genre of the ex-cop being called into the office and saying, you don't play by the rules, you break them, you're always late, you're rebellious. And then they turn around and say, yeah, but isn't that what I'm meant to be? And it felt a bit like that. And it was like, I don't know. Is that meant to be a pastiche? Are we homaging like Star Wars did? Well, it's like pretty much any cop show from the 80s, isn't it? Cop film from the 80s. It's that same sort of thing, the maverick cop. Who doesn't fit, doesn't conform, is rebellious and has a lot of baggage behind them they've got to resolve. And it's done so many times. And so maybe it's done in the film so it feels like Star Wars, that it's a homage to a different genre. Or is it just a rather simplistic archetype, which in a trailer just seemed a bit crass?
Well, is a simplistic archetype an archetype, or is a simplistic archetype a stereotype?
That's interesting. Well, I mean, I suppose archetypes aren't, are all relative. They're not all the same. So some are going to be more complex than others. Doesn't mean that they are a flat. It's interesting that. But I would still say it's an archetype.
So some kind of vague recommendations for you there, dear listener. Not of which Doctor Who, but hey, Doctor Who's not on at the moment, and you can quite easily watch The Invasion anytime you like. Ka-ching, I did it this time.
Oh, well done. I know, I was just thinking about doing it as well.
That brings us to the end of this week's podcast with a K. Goodbye. Beat you.